Welcome to Cannon Fodder, a behind-the-scenes look at the Glass Cannon Podcast.
The party lives! What's going on, guys? My name is Joe O'Brien, and this is Cannon Fodder.
And I am Generalissimo Troy LaValle. The benevolent Generalissimo.
The benevolent Troy. Yeah. You are the best, buddy. Yeah. You're the best.
Yeah, I am.
You are so lucky that Tim Hitchcock wrote that in there. Otherwise, I would have murdered you.
If he hadn't have written that in there, at least three of you were dead. Minimum two. Maximum four. Most likely three. Dead.
Oh, my God. I'm just like, I'm giddy.
Dead. Not even like, well, maybe if I make a reflex. No, dead. So yeah. Will, definitely dead. Baron, definitely dead. Nestor, maybe dead. And then who knows with Umlo and Baron. Yeah, it might just be the dwarves just would have survived and carried on.
Yeah, hired new help to help right. them win this war against the giants. Yeah, I said giddy. That's not really the right word. I'm just like shaking with adrenaline. You know, yeah. it is all just become. It was just such a wash to all of a sudden be like, boom! Like Will is not going to die. Will is going to survive, and it's not going to be some GMBS either. It's going to be by the book.
Yeah, and you were emailing me all week, texting me like, "Kill a new character." But since Will gonna die, I can't believe you're gonna kill Will. Bro, you got into a story. It was all these like hosts of emotions, and I just sat there laughing to myself.
You remember the one? You remember the one? I can't remember what I had emailed you about. It was something unrelated. It was something. It was something personal. I can't remember what it was, but it was just a couple lines. It was like business or something.
Right.
And then I hit return like 40 times.
Yeah, I was scrolling all the way down.
Like, why don't I just see the signature? You scroll all the way down to just the bottom. It said, "Please don't kill my character." And you know, we've preached our fair share of like, don't be too precious with your character. Don't worry about character death. And like, mm-hmm. and I had accepted it to a certain extent. And last week on Cannon Fodder, I said that I had something that I was going to say. And I'm glad that it just goes to show you like why we play together, why we're in a game together is because I was going to say that the thing that was irking me the most is I would rather have Will dead than have him live because you were benevolent for some unknown reason.
Right, like a deus ex machina.
Yeah, just because you didn't feel like killing us or killing Will this soon or killing Baron because he's the last one left of the True Now Four, the originals, killing Della because she's already on her second character, whatever the case may be, I was like, I don't want to deal with like feeling like there's that asterisk that we've talked about before. I don't want that. And I felt like that was something that was in danger of happening. And because you were evasive the whole time. And you do this a lot because you like to keep us surprised. Mm-hmm. But you never were like, all right, let's sit down and hammer out all of the details of your backup character. Like you didn't do that. You just sort of accepted the character sheet. You were like, cool, okay, good. And I just didn't know what to expect. And so I was frustrated, which is why you kept getting emails from me. And then, yeah, I think towards the end, I was just like, please don't kill my character.
Yeah. I mean, if I was a character, I wouldn't want to live because the GM just was like, all right, it flies away, you know?
Yeah.
But it's written in there. It couldn't be more specific. Less than 40 hit points, it flies off.
If I was a character, I wouldn't want to live because of infernal healing. But we'll get to that later.
Man, will we?
Do we have a lot to talk about in Cannon Fodder episode 31, covering episode 85 of the Glass Cannon Podcast? A monster episode.
A monster and a half. This might be a 3-hour Cannon Fodder.
I mean, if it's proportional to the episode, we're going at least 58 minutes. It is ridiculous how much happened in this episode. Now, not that there was, crazy amounts of plot development necessarily, but to think that you're starting off with essentially a TPK and then have that completely flipped on you and then to just be laying there bleeding out.
Right.
Drake gone. That's it.
Still taking bleed damage.
Talk about like a complete mind spin. Like I was just like, what? It was not what I was prepared for at all.
Yeah.
I had been practicing a new accent all week. and then here we are now. And it's, well, what do we do? Well, first thing we got to do is we got to pick ourselves up. We got to heal ourselves. We have to... And then it gets into role playing and motivations. And then we fight these new creatures. I mean, just a crazy, completely unexpected episode for me in a lot of ways. But I'm going to have to bring it back to that moment where Della decides to give infernal healing to Will. And, you know, this is Matthew's decision, and I respect it.
Through no goading of me.
Yeah.
By me.
Yeah, yeah, no, none at all. I respect it as a story decision, but it is tough. I'm going to have to figure out how to play with this here, because I think that it's, you're talking about a paladin detecting as evil.
It shouldn't be meaningless.
No, it shouldn't be meaningless. That's hard.
And I understand Della doing it. Like, I understand there is, even though Della is a grown woman who is coming into her own, there is still an innocence there. There is a great naivete that Sir Will shares as well.
Yeah, it's one of the main things they have in common.
But, you know, her making that decision, if you explicitly told her you want nothing to do with it, I mean, it's just very interesting. Very interesting in terms of this plot. Inter-character relationships.
I worry that she's driving a wedge. I think she's going to drive a wedge even further between them. This schism that we've talked about before that's developing, that certainly didn't help.
No.
GM Troy.
And now you're tainted.
Damn it. I know. Now I'm dirty.
You're dirty. You've got a dirty taint.
All right.
Same thing, right?
No? All right. We're having fun. Pause for edit. Then you give us an opportunity to talk about motivations. Now, what is the difference here between checking in with the characters and your desire to know what our motivations are in terms of the plot right now?
Right. Some would say it's the same thing. It's just semantics. But I really wanted to, rather than let you just pontificate
about how we feel, I guess.
It's like, I want to know specifically, you're here now. You're in Minderhall's Valley. Why are you here? What's your plan of action? Like, what do you want? Like you would do in any acting exercise. What do you want in this scene? What do you want in this adventure? And that's, to me, that's different than just a general, how do you feel? You know, that to me is like, going to a psychologist. So how do you feel? Tell me what's going on in your life. No, I want to know, why are you here? What do you want? Just make it very clear, because those primal urges and primal needs should affect every single one of your character's actions. And so doing that and trying to simplify, because I wanted to tell you guys what I thought it was, and then for you to tell me where I was right and where I was wrong. And I was pretty much right. You guys filled in, you made the lights lighter and the darks darker. You filled in the color and the nuances, but ultimately, you know, you've got Della, who is still discovering who she is while trying to figure out what happened to her past, while also trying to avenge Galabras.
Yeah, she's focused on this Brander thing, you know, which Sir Will doesn't really have that connection.
No.
Yeah.
They know who Brander is. Then you got Baron, who is, you know, coming to his own as a general, you know, finding religion.
Yeah.
Trying to discover who he is, literally who he
right.
is.
And focusing it through the deity. I think it's an interesting choice. And he's been moving this way for a little while now. And now it's showing itself as it's being revealed that this is becoming a kind of a religiously themed area, this Minderhall's Valley, a sacred place for giants.
Yeah. Then you got Nestor, who is, I mean, it's as pure and primal as it comes. Revenge. He was taken by a band of giants, similar to these prospectors and townsfolk from Shinnerman's Fortune, maybe to be used as tribute, and he wants revenge against whoever
knocked his teeth out.
Whoever knocked his, well, that guy's dead. It's whoever was in charge of the guy that knocked his teeth out, whoever set these giants on the path to do that. And that could be the Storm Tyrant.
He's Kaiser Soze. He's going to track down everyone that crossed him.
Right.
And take them all out.
Or die trying.
Totally.
And then you got Sir Will. And the way I put it is like he has connections to his family. He's doing something because of this adopted family. He's found a place now with this group after going many years, never really finding a place. Maybe even within his own family. It's not his real family, not finding a place. Fought demons in the world rune, but is now realizing that evil lurks even within the man you call friend.
Yeah, in the most subtle places. Yeah, and the idea of this grand quest.
Yes.
This grand quest of goodness. You know, it's romantic, but that's Will. You know what I mean? He's a knight. He has this idea of the knight in shining armor, and that's what he wants to be. So hopefully this gives him the chance to do something like that. And I enjoyed that scene. I liked the sirenscape, honestly. Came across something I hadn't come across before, the meditative soundtrack. It almost had like an Eastern feel to it, you know? It was like the wooden lute, or wooden flute, rather. It really put me in the zone. I was definitely there. I was a little shooken up by the Drake flying away and spending time healing and resting and all that kind of stuff, doing a lot of math when I was expecting to be trying to deal with a character death. But once that was a great, I think, choice in doing the motivation talk there, because it resettled me back into Will, back into the story. And then we were ready to take off. And it was going to be too short to just end the episode there. We had to keep going, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a good point when faced with literally your death to say, why am I living? You know?
Right.
Because you were all, every single one of you, all five of you were faced with mortality. So like, why am I continuing this? Why don't I just turn around?
Yeah.
Why? And so I think it was a good time to check in. Then you guys continue forward and you come across the Veds.
The Veds. I've never heard of these before.
No. They're from a different source book altogether. They're not even from the bestiary. They're sort of I liken them to like a hybrid between an ogre and a giant. They're these misshapen, weird giants that just look, pretty ugly.
They're not quite ogres, not quite hill giants.
Yeah, it's kind of a little bit of hill giant in them.
Something in between.
They look like giant Neanderthals is what they look like. It's like
giant cavemen. Yeah.
Giant cavemen, yeah. With their gale breath that could just...
Right.
Knock a man right off a horse.
Blow a halfling right off a wolf, as they say. Will went down and, you know, I got to tell you, little peek behind the curtain here of old Sir Willamette's handler, Joe O'Brien, that they took them out pretty quick. When he got blown down off of Lexington and hit the ground, do you know what my first thought was?
What?
I was like, I think it's time to take Uscroth's armor for a little spin.
Oh, a lot of people have been waiting for that. You thought that in that moment, you have
thought about it.
You have built this character to be not useless, certainly, while not mounted, but... I mean, in danger for his life.
He can't deal out damage. He can't
deal out damage.
No, when he's not mounted, he'll be just as defensive. His healing doesn't change. But he can't really deal damage. In this case, I don't know how that would change things. And I'm a little bit nervous about how to pursue it. I want it to mean something. That's the thing. And I'm not going to hold it off of myself to make it harder for myself. That's not what I'm doing.
No.
I just want it to be at an effective moment. And... Will is, this is part of his character, you have to understand. He's very effective, small. That's what he likes. He likes being small. He's very effective in that case. But I was like, ooh, this might be the time to stand up to this thing and be like human-sized Will. But I'm almost glad in a way, because they went down so easy from the other guys, our other damage dealers, that I was like, okay, it was not the right time yet. Because I don't want it to be like, oh, I grow big and then miss one attack and then everything dies and I just stand there big.
It's got to mean something. He's going to be the size of his adopted family.
But as he hit the ground, it was like, that's what I was thinking. It was like, oh my God, if this thing's going to kill me if I don't try to grow large right now, you know?
Right.
And then, luckily, Baron, Nestor, Della, Umlo, they did the work.
It's
and
like Frodo holding the ring, thinking he's going to put it on. Like,
right.
Not now.
Right, exactly. So that was a little moment there behind the scenes, what I was thinking. I didn't tell anybody that in the group. So we'll see if that situation presents itself again. But I think the other thing that you get out of this combat is this idea of the crossroads.
Oh, sure. You
know?
Yeah.
Now, we don't really know where we're going to go. We were able, luckily, to bring one of them back and interrogate him.
Yeah.
Briefly, and get some sort of sense that there's something to the south. So that's really vague. You know, we have that. But it does just start to open the door of this concept of, you know, okay, so this isn't a straight line right to the boss, which I guess, why would you expect that? But I hadn't really thought of it up until this point. And that's honestly going to be the start of our next episode, is going to be, I think, you know, if we can get more out of this creature, out of this vet, more interrogation, because I want to know more specifically what our options are, you know, which ways that we can go.
And it's pretty, when I gave you the flavor text, it's pretty clear there are multiple ways. It's no longer a straight line. So
Right. Yeah. So
I'll be interested to see what you do, and then have to prepare 10 times as much.
The sandbox. The sandbox for the GM. That's another thing we've talked about on Cannon Fodder before, is how much extra work that is. But it's so worth it for the players to let them make the choices, to let them choose which way to go. And then they're the masters of their own fate.
They really are.
As it were. And I didn't even think to do any checks for who was following us. Damn it. I forgot it.
It's Lucratus again.
you just have us in the zone. Yeah, I wonder if there's any Lucratus following us right now.
Hey, don't forget there's still a Drake out there with bloodlust.
That's right. He's healing up. Yep. Or she. He or she is healing up and coming at us again next time she needs another meal. Though, if she's just looking for a meal, I think she's decided we're not her mark. She's going to need to move on to something a little easier.
It's true. She did kill one of your horses. She was just taking a horse and call it a day.
You got greedy, Drake.
Damn it.
You got greedy.
Hate the Drake.
Man, that works for me every time. Works for me every time. All right, buddy. You know what? Let's get into a little listener mail. I want to hear back from the people.
It's time for listener mail. Gotta get your brain up on it. Time for listener mail. You gotta cue that bullshit.
You sure do.
Daniel, thank you so much for queuing that fucking A. He writes in from Boulder, Colorado, and it starts off with a really great anecdote. And I don't have time to read the whole thing, but basically, the gist is he was in a game through, I believe it was his girlfriend's coworker, and he got into this game. The coworker was GMing it. It was a homebrew, and he loved it. He said it was great. He had some great stuff in there, and they were having a great time. The GM's name is Zach, by the way. He wanted us to give him a shout out. Zach, good job being a good GM. Maybe you could teach Troy a thing or two.
Hey now.
So Zach, unfortunately, had to move away. He moved to Grand Junction, Colorado, across the state.
Great GM.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, really nice. Selfish
bastard.
Way
to go, Zach.
Yeah.
If that's your real name.
Oh, he thinks about us himself. He wasn't thinking about his players' fun when he made these life decisions. You see, that's a selfish GM right there. That's all it is. Well, Daniel was raving about Zach's game. He said it was fantastic. They had a great time, and he's very sad now that he moved across the state and they can't continue. Well, around the time that he moved away, and Daniel was looking for what to fill his time with, where to get this entertainment from, he saw through Zach's Facebook page that he was following us, Glass Cannon Podcast. So he decides to try it out. So Daniel tries out the Glass Cannon Podcast. He says he gets hooked immediately and he binge listens to the entire thing. Well, right around the time that the party is using the lantern with the will-o-wisp to magically go through the stone into the entrance of the Vault of Thorns, things start to sound a little familiar to Daniel. And then as we start to fight the Twig Jacks and then go into the bridge across and then a Wigga, and then, you know, as we get further into the Vault of Thorns, Daniel's thinking, Zach, you sneaky son of a bitch. He stole the Vault of Thorns. He took it and put it in his own game. Now, he repurposed it greatly.
Sure, you know, sure.
Did put a lot of new things in there, new twists. Made it personal to the characters, of course. Might change the monsters that were in there, what have you. But the map, the idea of the extra dimensional space, you know, those sort of things were all ported over and used in this homebrew. And Daniel's like, no wonder it was so good. he had taken it from this pre-written adventure and something maybe even Zach had heard about it from listening to the Glass Cannon Podcast, possibly, you know, rather than just reading it. So Daniel's question then becomes, have you, Troy, or I, have we ever repurposed material from an unrelated adventure for a game that you're playing? Can you think of any notable examples of major story elements you slipped into a game that came from an outside source?
I haven't. No, I try to, this Giant Slayer is only the second AP adventure path that I've run. The first, obviously, still being our Jade Region campaign. And
you've never pulled anything from another adventure?
You know, as I'm saying it, I realize I have, in the sense that in Jade Region, in the first book, part two of it is very open-ended and it utilizes a new mechanic that really hadn't been thought out perfectly and doesn't quite work. And so a third party publisher made a fill-in adventure for part two of book one of Jade Regent that you could just plug in. So that's the closest that I've come
and
to
and you use
it.
That.
And I use that. Now, I then repurposed that to fit the AP, but it was pretty much already done for you. They changed the names and places of, you know, for copyright reasons. I just changed them back, and then I kind of just connected it to you, your story, like I do with Giant Slayer as well. But, you know, I'm of a mind that the writers of these Paizo Adventure Paths are way better than I. And so the best thing I can do is just adapt my characters' stories to what they've made. So I have no reason to ever change it dramatically by porting in another Paizo Adventure.
Yeah, but you also, yeah.
I don't homebrew.
So. Right, you don't really homebrew. So I do a little more homebrewing than you. I don't do extensive homebrewing. I don't have a long-term campaign homebrew running or anything. But I've done these campaign or one-off adventures with you, have been involved in a few of them where I've homebrewed. And yeah, I always take stuff from published material. I always take, sometimes you know what my main motivation is? I just look for maps online.
Yeah.
And I just look through maps first. And then I see a map that really jumps out at me, and then I can start filling in story just looking at the map. That to me is, because it's much easier to write story around a map that you have that you want to put characters in, rather than trying to randomly find a gorgeous map of a story you came up with.
Yeah.
But you don't need to have a gorgeous map. You can always have a story you came up with and then just draw it out, you know, on a dry erase mat or whatever. So that's not always the priority, but that is one way that I've gone about it. I can't remember if we've talked about it on Cannon Fodder before, but I once, in my Council of Thieves game, put in a full session that was alternate dimension outside of the main story that was based completely around a Dark Souls 2 level that I just loved.
I remember you telling me about this.
I played it so many times because I died so many times that I could draw the entire level layout on a Pathfinder map. Like, I knew it so well. And I used a lot of the same creatures from that story. But then what I also did was I put NPCs in there from Dark Souls. And then in Dark Souls, there's a mechanic where you can summon creatures in. And as you, if you watch Troy's Twitch, you would see him summon in help to help him with boss fights and stuff like that. I gave them that mechanic in council going forward after that session. And so they could literally put soapstone signs on the ground.
That's cool.
And summon in NPCs from Dark Souls to help them fight sometimes.
This was the Iron Keep.
That's
location, right.
Right? Yeah. That is right. It was the Iron Keep. And it made a great Pathfinder level, I'll tell you, because it wasn't too complex. Had plenty of lava. There was like concerns of falling damage over bridges and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it had that imposing fortress vibe about it. And I built it around this concept because Council of Thieves all takes place in Cheliax, which is the land of the devils. And so I had it be they basically went on a trip to hell briefly, to one of the layers of hell, and they were at this Iron Keep of this great, you know, like an archdevil of Asmodeus oversaw. And the boss fight was straight out of the boss from that level. And I converted all of the smelter demons moves and everything into Pathfinder moves, into
that
Pathfinder
is
terms.
Awesome. Hey, don't sleep on Dark Souls 2. That level is a perfect indication of why that game was amazing.
And the players loved it. I'm telling you,
yeah.
They loved that boss. It was a great boss. It was a really interesting fire boss. It was really a lot of fun. And what else?
And I have talked in the past that one of our first games, the first game that I got back into, eventually when we got to higher enough levels, he ported in Tomb of Horrors into the game.
Yeah, we mentioned that before.
He played through Tomb of Horrors. Essentially, he had changed it as well.
Yeah, he repurposed it to our story. But yeah, he was just using
Tomb of Horrors. He had to, because Skid had it memorized probably from childhood.
Right.
But that's exactly. Something I'd like to do is go back and get old AD&D modules when I'm not playing with Skid, which is never, and port in some of that stuff from the classics that I never even played. You know, there's so many of those great ones that I never played, and bring those into a...
Think about our Larry Wilhelm interview, how he had discussed bringing in, you know, not obviously direct stuff, but just inspiration from those old giant fighting
against the
giants. And that was inspiration for some of the layouts and things that he had done for part two of Giant Slayer. Another thing that I'll say is that one of my main problems with Pathfinder layouts and maps is that I believe that they tend to be too small and that combats tend to be too tight to get across the fun nature of a lot of the abilities of a lot of the classes, including the bosses. And everything just kind of gets hemmed in, and your caster boss ends up just being immediately surrounded and flanked, and then really can't get away and is completely powerless up against a bunch of melee characters in close range and just goes down too quickly. So one of the things that I do to solve that is I'll go online and just find another map that I like better, that's much bigger and wider and open, and I'll specifically have the combat in a much larger space. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this, but there have been multiple occasions in which I have taken the pre-written area, which is like the inside of a building or an apartment of some kind, and it becomes like, due to some magic, slightly opened to like partially into another world. You know what I mean? And it's because I want more room to work with, to fight in, so that the combats are a little bit more dynamic. So that's another thing that I've done, is literally just had the story be the same, but put it in a different location so that I have more room to work with.
You know, and if you're running published adventure paths, you can go on the Paizo boards and read about, we've said this before as well, read about every single book from every single adventure path and what people did to change things, because maybe an encounter was too easy, maybe an encounter was too hard, maybe this like level design just wasn't working out, and you may completely disagree, but you may be like, you know what, it's not working out for me either. Oh, you just brought in a map from over here, or you had the players do this or that. So this isn't just for homebrews. If you're just trying to alter certain sections that just aren't clicking with you with a published adventure path, you can go to the Paizo boards, find the book and the adventure path you're talking about, and see what other people did to spice or beef things up.
Yeah, and to change it off of, you know, battle maps and all that kind of stuff, another thing that I've done in the past is I've brought in inspiration for role-playing and for campaign story arcs and plot from books that I love. So I've mentioned before on Cannon Fodder that I loved the Kingdoms of Thorn and Bone series by Greg Keyes. And that first book, The Briar King and Into the Charnel Prince, there's this storyline between some nobles that I really liked, and I totally stole that and repurposed it and used it in my Council of Thieves game, because that was an urban adventure with an aristocracy and a peasant class. And I took a couple of the characters that they had created and I changed their relationship and their goals and everything based on this really awesome contentious storyline in that book. And it worked out really well. So yeah, then another idea is to use plot and character relationship stories that you have found in books that you love and repurpose that into adventures. It also helps to role play better, because you feel like you know the character so much better if you just take the character that you love from a book you already know.
Oh yeah, if you're running an adventure path or a homebrew, whatever you decide the setting is going to be, you should be reading fantasy novels or historical fantasy or historical novels themselves about that period. Like, I read Shogun before I even read page one of Jade Regent.
You read it because you knew you were going to run
Jade Regent. Because I knew I was going to run Jade Regent. Joe said, well, if you're going to run that, you got to read Shogun. And it has helped me immensely, and it allowed me to like put in dream sequences with very elaborate tea ceremonies that I pulled straight out of
Shogun. You never would have known anything about
that. I never knew anything about that until I read that. So I mean, you should be doing that if you're a GM as well. I mean, if you look at the back of the core rule book, it tells you like fantasy novels you should be reading that inspired the creation of these books.
Yeah.
But if you're if you're running Council of Thieves and it all takes place in a place like Cheliax, which is just thieves and murderers, you know, you should read novels that are like that.
You should read The Lies of Locke Lamora if you're going to run an adventure in Westcrown. You know, it is a fantasy novel about an orphan kid growing up a thief in a really urban setting that's almost sort of colonial. There's like muskets and stuff like that. It's like modern fantasy-ish. But that's a great book. And I read that when I was running Council of Thieves. And I was so much more able to get into the mindset of like a guy that's running a cell of thieves in a corner of the city. Like, I can't, you know, just coming up with ideas for how to make them seem more three-dimensional and realistic. You can definitely get it from, you know, relating fantasy novels.
I guess the key thing is steal. Steal from everywhere. Steal often. And then your campaign will be really good.
All right, that's going to do it for us this week, guys. Daniel, thank you so much for writing in. I really appreciated the story. I thought it was fantastic. And I hope we gave you some ideas for how to repurpose stuff from other adventures. And good luck running your own game now that Zach has abandoned you. remember, you can always write us at glasscannonpodcast@gmail.com with your thoughts, your comments, your questions, your critiques. And we do our level best to read those and get back to you as soon as we can. All right, buddy. Well, thank you as always for taking the time. I appreciate you answering the questions, and I will see you in a few days.
Yeah, lots of decisions to make for the old True Now 4.5. See what they choose.